probably, it'll be a mommy hustle, it'll probably fail, and but I'll get some rookie mistakes out of the way. I was going to people's homes and collecting their things to bring them to like 100 cobblers I was testing.
Just such an unparalleled view into what actually is it that customers need, want.
You can feel like you have your community network sorted, and but you have your skin stress tested it under scale. I think if you're not raising millions of dollars, okay, it's time to really scale. Was the first time where I was like, should we shut this whole thing down? It wasn't exactly what it seemed, and it was a bit of a rushed marriage, and it turned out not to be a very good one.
It takes balls to get back up.
Everybody finds wisdom in a downturn.
Right. Vanessa Jacobs is the New Yorker turned Londoner, co-founder of Circulo, her third venture. She's also the former CEO and exited founder of The Restory, a luxury aftercare service, named as one of Walpole's Brands of Tomorrow back in 2019. A circular economy expert, passionate about designing great customer experiences and building the infrastructure to scale. Welcome to the show, Vanessa.
Thank you. Lovely to be here.
So you are obviously a circular economy expert, passionate about the space. What first ignited your passion before it was even a trendy term?
So I am not one of these natural entrepreneurs. I can't work for anyone. I'm too independent. That I'm not one of those types. And nor did I actually come at this from a sustainability point of view at all. The kind of background story is that I was it was 2008. I was new to London. I had just my Swedish fiance had become my Swedish my Swedish boyfriend became my Swedish fiance. He got an opportunity to move here to London. I was desperate to get out of banking, so I was like, "Yes, I'll follow you anywhere." My big ambition at the time was to be a management consultant. So I had my interview lined up at Accenture, and as one would do in New York, I went and got my this specific suit that I felt like a badass in, and I got my suit pressed, and I went to get my shoes shined up, and this cobbler just he broke the shoe and was like kind of licking his teeth and telling me that they weren't broken and calling me love and all this stuff, and this is all like this archetype, but like it was even so much stronger having not been from here, and then he told me he wouldn't shine the shoes because they weren't profitable. So like I just picked my jaw up off the floor, went home, got a new pair of shoes, spent the next 8 years at Accenture quite happily. But that kind of experience had just planted a bit of a seed in my mind that I couldn't let go of. And over the years, I would like every interaction I would have with a brand, particularly an expensive brand who wouldn't help me access like the level of care I wanted for the expensive thing I bought, and every kind of other teeth-licking guy in a dry cleaner, like all of this just like festered and became this huge problem.
Yeah.
And so I actually solved this. I wanted to see something in the world. I just created it for me.
Yeah, I love that.
Like I didn't, and it just, really kind of, of course I was aware of how dirty the fashion industry was and all of this, but I cared about it, but that wasn't the first problem I was trying to solve. I was trying to solve for trust and experience.
Yeah, okay, all right. So I'm gonna rewind a little bit because there's a few bits I wanna get stuck into there. So one is, that's an experience that I feel like a lot of women can relate to. It was funny actually, because I was just reading about that pain point that you experienced with the archetype, as you described, with like grumpy old man with an attitude problem at a dry cleaners. Funny enough, this is not a word of a lie, such a coincidence. I just picked up this exact blazer I'm wearing now from the dry cleaners yesterday.
Okay.
And I had that exact same experience.
Okay.
And it's funny,
they still exist.
They still exist. And it is still that like painful one man band, independent little shop. Maybe some of them don't even take card. They're not really modern. They're not really prioritizing that customer service. And it really stands in such stark contrast to the luxury fashion space. And so coming back to your shoes that this cobbler broke, obviously you still got the job anyway, right, at Accenture? So you did get the job. Well, it didn't hinder your confidence too much in the interview then. So you had this power suit. I have to ask as well, what was that power suit that you wore to the interview?
I mean, I think at the time it was like a Benetton suit or something like that.
Yeah.
It wasn't anything
but
special.
But it gave you that confidence.
But kind of going back to your point that these men, mostly, I don't mean to demonize them, some of them are lovely, but this experience, like, it's these, yeah, it's like these kind of old men with attitude problems, or, you know, and they're catering mostly to women.
The opposite demographic.
Because, you know, breadwinner or stay-at-home mom, you're controlling all of that kind of spend in the household.
Yeah, definitely.
And I also felt like there was like this massive disconnect between, like, you have no appreciation for, like, what this thing, the role that this thing plays in my life, be it functional, I didn't pay the rent to get it, or, you know, or it was my mom's. Like, they just have no...
Yeah, totally.
And so I felt like that was part of the experience I was trying to solve as well.
I can, like, completely...
Like, I understand what that jacket means to you, because it goes with everything, and, like, I get it.
Exactly. You would totally get it, but this guy who sorted out the dry cleaning could not give less of it. Anyway, so this was, you said, around 2008, so this was, you know, a while ago, and this was for this interior extension, and then you got that job, you were there for a few years, but you mentioned that you'd identified that pain point that you'd experienced as an individual, and so was that the kernel of that entrepreneurial idea that then led to the Restory?
Yes.
That
was the kind of small seed in the ground that kind of led to it and started to fester, and then around 2000... late 2013, I had my second son, and you know, I knew I wasn't gonna get fired, but I knew how this was gonna go, that I was gonna kind of languish in a certain place at Accenture for a long period of time, my career, I was gonna stall out for a while, and I knew from my own personality, I was gonna find that deeply, deeply frustrating. Mm. So I had been, you know, I had had this experience before with Film Chicks, my first accidental venture. my husband and I had made a couple angel investments. So I kind of, I had this, you know, I was like, I have this idea, I'll give it a go. It'll be a mommy hustle. It'll probably fail, but I'll get some rookie mistakes out of the way, and I can always go back to consulting when I'm older.
So interesting that was your mindset going into it, and linking it back to what you said at the start around, you know, not being that typical entrepreneur, the rebel who can't work for somebody else. Yeah. I think it's really interesting to also shine that light on the different personalities and profiles, and today what it means to be an entrepreneur. There's such a wide gamut of profile, what that could look like for someone, because I completely resonate again with what you were saying there. I went to school, I did well academically, I went into employment, I'm not this kind of never had a job, dropped out at 60, set it up, but I've still been an entrepreneur.
Archetype that the world has put out there.
Right.
You're nothing if you're not raising millions of dollars.
Right. Yeah. These
meanwhile,
like tech
nobody
bros.
Talks about like your equity's this big.
Yeah. Exactly. It's funny. It's funny the side of the story that people want to tell, right?
Yeah.
But it's also, I mean, it's interesting all that mindset that you were in when you started the Restory. So this was back in 2017, right? If I'm not mistaken.
So actually, the first attempt was 2014.
Oh, okay.
It started out as a retail-led concept, and it was like, in my mind's eye, it was like Joe and the Juice meets this shoe shine shop, but you could also kind of drop your stuff, it would all be done elsewhere, but you could drop and collect like kind of in these stores.
Oh, okay.
And
so more kind of a cafe. When you say Joe and the Juice, is somewhere you could go and stop for a coffee and drink.
Yeah, kind of like a vibey dry cleaner with a
nice.
Shoe shine stand.
Okay.
And I, but I quickly realized that A, you're the cheapest form of labor there is, and that sucks. And I was like, okay, this is going to take a lot of capital, and I have no track record, and you know, and I'm not up for the ride to get the one prototype in the right place. And in the meantime, prior to setting that up, I'd been telling like basically the moms on the school run like that I was going to do this, and I needed to test partners that I was going to send people's shoes to. So I was going to people's homes and collecting their things to bring them to like the 100 cobblers I was testing. And I would go into their homes and they would, you know, they'd be like, this is so great, you're in my home. So I was like, I could do this another way. This doesn't need to be in a retail space.
Mm.
So I did that. So I did that first concept for about 4 months, shut it down. had this noodle of an idea that it could be done somewhere else. Went to a friend of mine in tears. I was like, you need to talk me off the cliff. I just blew all this money, shut it down in 4 months. I'm a total failure. She was like, no, 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 you learned a lot. And this is totally valid. And she was somebody who was this, she styles like super celebrities. And she was like, you need to point this really high end. And I was like, well, you know, really? Do they want this? She's like, oh yeah. And I followed her around for a few months and I would go into these enormous wardrobes and I would get the pile, the fix it pile. You know, they always have like the throw away, fix it pile. And I would do the fix it pile. Hmm. And but I got to talk to the owners of these clothes, their assistants, their stylists. Like I would get, so I got an idea of like what people wanted, and that was kind of my test bed.
Really being directly on the front line, speaking to customers.
Yeah.
Like it also sounds a bit like the concierge MVP that I think is talked about in like Lean Startup book, for example, where. Another version of it is kind of like the Mechanical Turk, where you're still there, you're the one doing that heavy lifting, whether it's going directly into people's homes, whether it's you updating the order status online, you know, whatever that looks like exactly.
Doing the unscalable thing first.
It's so frowned upon from that scale operational efficiency perspective, but right in those early days, it gives you just such an unparalleled view into what actually is it that customers need, want, speaking to them, like nothing compares to that.
Well, I didn't even know that anybody wanted it. I mean, I knew, I had a feeling there were other people like me, but I wasn't like, I don't live on the Boltons. Like I wasn't one of those people, but I was like, oh, but if they want it, then
there could
then
be
there's
something
more.
Okay, yeah. Interesting. So that was what led to, so you kind of had that first pancake, which we all have.
Yeah.
And so, then you
so
kind
that's
of relaunched.
So that's what kind of gave me enough juice to go out and kind of start the Restory.
Amazing.
So that was the start of the Restory.
So what was the 2014 business? Was it not the same name?
So it was called the Shine Box.
Uh-huh.
So the 2014 business I only had for 4 months. And then I shut it down and I went stealth for a year following my friend around into the Boltons. And then 2016, late 2016, I incorporated as the Restory.
Okay.
Then I got with a branding person, a brilliant guy named Hugh Morse, and we rebranded the whole outfit and relaunched it in 2017. And the people had started asking me for more and more leather goods type stuff, particularly color discoloration. And, you know, when, like, the leather goods scratch up against something. And, like, nobody did that. Now you see it in lots of places, but absolutely nobody did that back then. So the first thing I had to do was find somebody who could, like, you know, I had the guy who could fix the shoes. I had some seamstresses. Those were easy things, but this other thing was, like, going to be really hard.
Mm-hmm.
So long story short, I went through a lot of people and tried a lot of different things, and ultimately I found Thais, who was who became my first co-founder. And the joke was, we were all working out of a spare bedroom in my house. And the joke was that, I would service the customers and she'd figure out how to get pen marks out of crocodile bags. And
nice.
I still have dye stains on the floor in that bedroom.
Oh,
from the early days of the Restory.
I love that.
And then when Thais had enough tricks up her sleeve to, you know, we felt like we could go to market, we brought on Emily. And that was like summer 2017. So.
Amazing.
So that's when that's when we really got going.
And so in a nutshell, what was the core value proposition for the Restory?
It was that you had this magical place called the Restory that you could, you know, you could just send your things. It's totally hassle-free. And you know that somebody understands what that thing means to you and they're going to look after it like it's yours. And it's, you know, it's going to be easy and you can trust it.
Amazing. It has that appreciation for those garments that some of those guys are lacking. So the Restory was a bit of a rough ride for you guys. You got a lot of press coverage from some big titles, Vogue Business, WWD, The Times, covered, you know, when things sort of took a turn a few years later.
So in some way, so all businesses, you know, all businesses have... you know, a lot of things have to happen and they have to happen together and they have to happen at the same time. So demand-wise, value proposition-wise, we never had a problem. We always had way more demand than we could ever service. And that was the good side. So we, like, immediately we were getting picked up by press. Our Instagram was like hockey stick, like all that stuff was great. What started happening, you know, over time was that the more we grew, the worse the unit economics got. So we, even though we were starting to build some tech to kind of get around things like that, but you know, we always had this thing that, you know, we always thought that that unit economics would get sorted out with scale, which like just absolutely doesn't happen. Even if you have a lot of tech behind it, it's still, you know, you can feel like you have your unit economics sorted, but you haven't necessarily stress tested it under scale. So what you really need to understand is like, can your unit economics hold in a high growth phase? Mm. And I think that's what a lot of people miss.
So what was the reason for that with you with the restaurant? Because typically you have all the upfront investment to go into the tech and then the scaling.
So we didn't have a lot of upfront investment. Right. We had kind of investment that trickled in. We were building tech. But it was getting, you know, when you're reliant on external funding, then you have to keep growing because you keep needing to raise the next round. So we never had enough runway to just be like, we're going to pause and sort out the leaky ship. Mm-hmm. So when the pandemic hit, we had just finished a raise, and it was the first time we ever had like a good chunk of cash in the bank, and we were like, this is great. We're not going to push a boulder up the hill because everyone was going online and the Google rates were just going through the roof. So we were like, we're gonna get into the hull of the boat and we're gonna fix everything. So we built, and at that point we had Harvey Nichols, we had Selfridges, we had our DTC business. So we knew we had Harrods coming. We had enough scale to understand what it needed to do, how it needed to work, where we needed it to rip costs out, but we also had enough experience with lots of different partners that we knew that we had to build this in a super flexible way because they're going to want to do it different to these guys, and we know Harrods is coming, they're probably going to want it different, we don't know who's coming down the pipe. So we built it sort of out of a bit of forward thinking, but we built it as a multi-tenant system. Hmm. because we had, you know, we
space
just took the view that
us.
We're just another brand sitting on our platform. So that was, we spent that whole year and basically all the money just really building that
that
platform.
COVID was a blessing in disguise.
It was
in
a blessing,
terms of
yeah.
affording you that time, that runway, but you'd also thankfully had just closed fundraise beforehand. So you
yeah.
had the luxury of both time and money
yeah.
to kind of look at that.
And it also was the first time where I was like, should we shut this whole thing down and just be a tech business?
Mm.
Like, it was the first time I had had that. And we had this, we had our board meeting like two weeks before, and I had brought it up, and I brought it up several times over the years. Should we not just peel off the operations and like make the tech business its own business? We'll get that business to wash its face.
Mm.
And it will license the tech from this business.
Mm.
But you know, the investors, the board was, you know, then you're just going to have a business with no revenue. We're like, yeah, but it'll have like half the costs. So that was the first time we had a fork in the road, and we could have gone one way, and we stayed the course.
Mm.
But we did invest a ton in the platform just to make those unit economics close
yeah.
that gap.
Interesting that your investors and the board weren't as receptive to that idea of doubling down on the tech side of things. Do you think that they were a bit like, this is the deal that we bought into, this is the business that we're investing in, and sort of just wanted to stay?
Yeah, that was a little bit of it So the person who was with us at that meeting had brought in a lot of investment. So there, maybe there was some of that, but also it's an emerging industry, and it still is a little bit, you know, it still is a little bit early.
Mm.
So it's, you know, it was like, well, how long is that going to take?
Mm.
And you're gonna build this big thing like before anybody actually wants it.
Mm. So is this also what you meant around this time? I read that you put somewhere about, you know, feeling that pressure to scale and those unit economics not quite working out. Was that the external investment that kind of took the pressure up a notch?
So that was when that investment enabled us. It didn't put us in the black, but it did enable the curve to start, however you draw the graph, but it started trending toward black, and it was definitely going nowhere. So coming out of the pandemic, we had Harrods in the pipeline, but we closed Harrods, Farfetch, Manolo Blahnik, Nicholas Kirkwood. Like in that year, we brought on six-ish other brands. So that was like a high growth phase for us, and everyone was like, okay, it's, you know, it was now it's the end of kind of mid 2021. The pandemic's definitely over. We've all got our jabs. We're like, all right, now is the time to scale.
To ramp things up.
Yeah. So that's when, you know, all the retailers were coming back online. We had Farfetch and a couple of small brands at that point. And the big pressure at the time from the investors was like, okay, it's time to really scale. And from the brown side, the pressure was like, when are you getting to America?
So
there was kind of all that pressure.
And so we're edging towards the next big chapter in the restory with the US, the acquisition. So I love the line in terms of exits around you, businesses don't get sold, they get bought. And so I read that you had a US competitor, right?
Yeah.
You had a US competitor that reached out to you initially to gauge a merger potentially, and what happened next there?
So that had been like, I don't know, probably a little bit after the pandemic, and we just kind of like blew it off. But we kept them in our sights because we knew that they had just raised a lot of money. So we knew that they were someone to keep an eye on. But we weren't really thinking about that. So we're under all this pressure to, like, you know, to really grow. We're scaling fast. We were also like running the business really hot. We had brought on an FD. We'd brought on a director of operations, like, so it was, you know, it was that kind of classic, I think some people talk about when you go from...
like startup to scale up.
No, but it's like 7 to 17 employees to 75, there's a great PE company that's invested in like proper corn and stuff. I can't think of their name at the moment, but they used to do this podcast and they used to talk about this a lot.
Right.
So we were kind of getting into that phase. We had a lot of staff and we were setting the business up so that when an investor, you know, when the Series A money hit the bank account, we would hit the ground running, and that's what we were doing. Obviously the trouble came, and then we ran into 2022, and then like, boom, it was like inflation, war, you know, all the VCs are starting to, you know, keep their powder dry because they need to protect the investments they've already made. So we kind of ran into that whole thing, and we were like, you know, and then honestly, we were getting a little bit long in the tooth and like things like that. So we were like, all right, we need to do something big.
Isn't it crazy, by the way, sorry to just interject here really quickly, but isn't it crazy how all of those horrific things that happened in the more recent years were worse than the global pandemic in 2020? Because yeah. I definitely experienced many more worse things in those years afterwards than the global pandemic.
Yeah, because the government stepped in and saved all of our businesses. And
right.
In some ways, it's not really fair of me to say because I'm not a very vulnerable person, but I think it was, in some ways, it wasn't healthy. I think it kept a lot of businesses that weren't viable.
Yeah.
It enabled them not to take necessary pivots or just stood up a lot of businesses that need to be there.
No, you're completely right. I think when there is too much...
And I include us in that as well.
Okay, interesting. Thank you for being vulnerable and saying that about your own business there. Yeah. But no, it is true. I mean, this is where at the moment, without going off course here, but where things have been so tough and we have had these macroeconomic challenges and all the rest of it, you know, VC funding has dried up. It is so, so tough, but it's meant that you can't forgive... You know, there's a lot of businesses that, you know, that really been pushed to the limits, right? And that really has risen to the challenge. A lot of them were kind of forgiven, if you like, with that, all the extra capital and all of those kind of headwinds.
And the loans and,
right, yeah. right.
Quick one. This is Future Steph coming to you from beyond. If you're enjoying this episode, then you can probably guess what I want you to do. Please do me one tiny favor that costs you nothing and takes a second of your time. Hit that subscribe button. It really helps to support this show, and I'm really grateful for you listening. Let's get back into it.
So back to you and this next chapter with the restaurant.
And I did always say, I was like, we're going to pick, we have to, this will come back. We have to, it'll, you know, on the one hand, you're coming out of the pandemic and you're like, you know, it's a post-war economy, you know, like how, if you're not growing, like you're an idiot. Mm. And there's some,
but then the rest of the world validity, has other ideas.
There's some validity to that. I mean, think about like the, you know, 1950, I mean, like the world needed to be rebuilt. If you were participating in that, you probably did really, really well. On the other hand, you know, the government just printed all of this money. Like, it had to come back. You know, nobody could have predicted Ukraine and all that. But the inflation, I mean, that's pretty easy.
Exactly.
On reflection, it's like, duh.
Yeah, hindsight's a wonderful thing, isn't it? So getting back to the restory and kind of what's next in the story here for you guys.
So 2022, we needed to do something big. We approached our competitor. We said, are you ready to do a deal? We're ready to do a deal if you are, and the idea was that they would everything would come under the Restory brand because we had a brand problem. We felt that they had sorted out a bunch of operational things that we felt that we hadn't. That was our impression, at least. We were going to continue to build out Europe, and they were going to be in America. To cut a long story short, it wasn't exactly what it seemed, and it was a bit of a rushed marriage, and it turned out not to be a very good one. Mm. On the upside, didn't last very long, and they never really valued the B2B opportunity, so we kept the technology.
That is a fantastic, benefit that you had in the process, which I want to hear more about in a second, but just sticking with this horrible part in your journey, because I know that things all went kind of south there. I saw online that some of those big titles covered what was happening in terms of all three co-founders walking out, the staff being terminated, just all kind of, Vogue Business, WWD, The Times, like those titles were covering what was going on. How did that affect you while you're going through this incredibly fraught time in the business? And did you manage to keep some of that press kind of at arm's length, even mentally?
So we felt like, we couldn't stand by. And if we stood by any longer, we were going to be complicit in what was happening. And we felt like, one of my big entrepreneurial lessons is like your relationships really matter, and you really need to protect. You need to protect those. And I felt like, if we stand by, we are going to burn every relationship we've just spent the last, 7 years building. Mm. And they're going to think this is us. Mm. And so we felt like that's why we felt like we needed to do like a big public resignation.
Stepping away from it.
Yeah.
I mean, it takes years to build a relationship and, seconds to break it, doesn't it?
Yeah, 100%. So we were like, we needed to send a big signal to the market that what's happening is not us. We don't support this. Mm. It wasn't us that let the staff go.
It's interesting then. So that was more of a concerted effort for you to kind of make sure that you got the story straight, that was out there in the world, people knew.
Well, we had thousands and thousands of people's things. in our facilities,
right,
that we weren't, that needed to be looked after.
Yeah, and all the way
because
back.
They mean something.
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
And
this is what I was going to say, kind of all the way back.
And we weren't sure that we didn't feel like we had enough control to look after people properly. So we had to let them know that we're not in control, and so we're not
a part of this.
We're not a part of this.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, it's interesting that, you know, we circle way back to those key words at the start around that trust, that care, that appreciation.
Yeah.
And so obviously this was in direct conflict to those core values that you hold personally and as a business. So the tech thing that
you
mentioned.
The great thing about repair is that the, you know, the emotional coefficient of something like looking after something that somebody already owns and likes it enough that they're gonna that they want it back, that they're gonna trust you with it and they want it back. I mean, that's the beauty, that's the opportunity in it. The downside is that it's, you know, the unit economics are really tough, and operationally it's quite complex.
Mm, yeah, no,
so,
it makes
sense. So it's tough business
sense.
To run.
Yeah, yeah, it sounds like it. So you walked away with the tech that you mentioned before. So that was a massive blessing, that was a huge kind of silver lining in all of this. So talk us through a little bit more what that actually meant. So you had your proprietary technology, but you managed to kind of keep a hold of that in that deal.
When they shut the company down, it wasn't part of the asset base.
Yeah, amazing. And so what have you been able to do with that since?
So me, my former co-founder, now current, so me and three from my team, my co-founder, Emily Vipasha Shiel, who ran product for us, and our long-term fractional CTO, Karm Khanna, the four of us have come back together under a new umbrella called Circulo. And it is to pursue that pivot that we never really took in 2020.
Mm.
So it's an enterprise SaaS platform to enable fashion and product brands to run and operate their own repair service and incorporate that as part of alongside their linear value proposition.
It must feel so liberating and exciting to explore a venture that you were kind of pushing for. You already had those ideas, but despite even being the co-founder of your own business, you sort of felt, well, the investors, the board, the partners, you know, they weren't quite on board with, you know, this potential avenue, and now you're getting to explore.
Yes, and they're all represented on our new cap sheet, or our new cap table as well. So we brought all the other, all the old investors have been brought back with us.
Yeah, exciting.
Yeah. So
amazing.
Yeah, I always said to them, I can only promise you two things. Like, A, I'll respect your money, the way I would respect your clothes. I'll respect your money, and I'll be right there with you. And both of those things are still true today. And
yeah.
I think that's part of looking after those relationships long term.
I'm really excited for this new venture with you, because obviously you've learned so many lessons along the way, and there's such great research that goes to show that with each next venture, the chances of success steadily increase with that. And so obviously if we count Film Chicks, Shinebox, The Restory, now Circus. So this is your fourth, fifth venture, you know, if we kind of count all of those.
Yeah, fourth-ish.
So that chart. So, you know, it does take an incredible amount of resilience. I know they're such buzzwords, but it takes balls to get back up, you know, dust yourself off, especially if you've gone through quite a stressful situation like an acquisition that didn't quite work out.
Well, it's an outcome. It just wasn't the outcome we necessarily wanted. And yeah, there's still some trauma that we're, you know, that we're still processing.
I'm sure there is. But what would you say are the biggest lessons that you've learned from that process? Because, you know, you've got the tech. Due diligence, I'm sure you've learned a thing or two.
Well, I mean, ultimately, you know, had we gone into that negotiation in a stronger position, we would have had time to do due diligence. We would have had time to, you know, do more things that would have potentially resulted in something different. So ultimately, we have no one to blame but ourselves. I was the CEO, so I have no one to blame but myself. And I think that, you know, there's a couple big lessons I took away. One was that the relationships are your most important thing. And I think that I think a lot of Americans particularly don't appreciate that because the country's so damn big, and this is a small country. Like, you need to you especially really need to look after your relationships. The other thing is the bit about the unit economics. So if you can sort out your unit economics and you can make sure that that they sustain themselves under scale, then everything below that line in the P&L is basically an optional cost. So, you know, and that was Emily, that was me, you know, like our FD, like all of that could have gone away had the business been able to wash its face. And then from there, you can choose to run your business in the black or the red, depending on what your funding sources are. But but you have to get those, the margins just have to work.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely.
And you gotta have, you know, you gotta have enough of them because things go up and down a bit. So you gotta...
Especially these days, you know, the buzzword at the moment is all about profitability, runway. You need to make sure you've got those margins.
Yeah, everybody finds wisdom in a downturn.
Right.
You know, and it's funny because, like, I knew these things. I'm not 30 under 30, you know. Like, I'd had a Wall Street career. Like, I knew that everybody finds fundamentals when that was the buzzword back then. You found fundamentals. I remember when I was coming out of business school, it was after .com, and everyone that I was in business school with who were studying finance, our dreams were to go to a bank and then get to a hedge fund. That was like what everybody wanted to do. And everybody was saying, no, I don't want to go into equities. I don't want to go. It's too crazy. Everyone wanted to go into fixed income, which is debt. And this was, and I remember thinking like, this is a phase,
we all go through these cycles,
yeah,
don't we?
Yeah.
So when you're saying like you knew those things, you
I
have
knew
that
those
Wall Street,
things, but even, but when I was living it, it was still hard to
actually put it into practice.
It's like I said, like coming out of the pandemic, it was, you know, it was a post-war economy. On the other hand, we'd printed all this money, and like printing money means inflation. Like so I knew all of that stuff, but how do you balance that? And especially how do you balance that if you need the money? Like if you're not profitable, you need to keep growing to attract the next round of investment. I mean, how do you balance those things?
Am I correct?
And that's the kind of the real world stuff that like people who, you know, when I was just an analyst on Wall Street, that was the stuff. That's the stuff you don't get. That's that operator experience that people don't understand.
Is this the difference of, you know, almost not seeing the wood for the trees, so to speak, in terms of, you know, when it's your own business, you're so close to it, you're in it, you've got more of that emotion, as opposed to an analyst on the outside that can look at it more cleanly with the numbers?
I mean, I think there's it's not that I couldn't see the forest through the trees, but it was, you know, you are only dealing with the best information you have at the time, and you have to make a call.
Mm.
So you can see the forest, but you still got to get through it somehow. And how do you do that?
Yeah, and you've got challenges in that process.
It wasn't a vision problem. It wasn't. Mm. It wasn't a, like I said, it was never a demand problem. It wasn't even a product market fit problem. It was a scale and a profitability problem.
Mm, interesting.
It's scalability and profitability.
So many think that once you achieve that magical product market fit and you have the demand, like everything else falls into place.
Yeah.
But actually, because you went further with this business and you had all of that success, your own particular story has demonstrated that, of course, there are more challenges to scaling a successful business. There's those other things that are at play here. So I was actually going to touch on your decision-making frameworks, because I completely relate to the fact that, you know, we all live very busy lives, especially if we've got kids in the picture as well, and you've got the realities of if you haven't had a good night's sleep, or you've got meetings, you know, you've got the real life, the day-to-day. And so exactly on your point there, you can only ever make, you know, the best decision with the information you've got at any point in time. So where do you go for when you have to make, if you have to make a big decision or a tough decision, what do you have, like a framework or a process that you use for arriving at, you know, what needs as CEO?
So I'm a bit older than a 30 under 30. So I think that my generation tends to like kind of hold things in, but I know I have to force myself to just go out and talk to people, because the process of articulating it gets it out of your head. Otherwise, just kind of like ricocheting between your ears. So the first thing I do is just go and talk to, like, you know, as I'll go through my phone and just scroll through the names and like somebody, I'll be like, you know what, that person, I'm going to call that person because they tend to frame things, you know, or they simplify things, or they've been through this before, things like that. So I look, the first thing I do is kind of look for people. Look, you know, you look to your team, obviously, but then you look externally as well for people who are totally detached.
And do you find that they help you arrive at a decision that you knew was probably something that you would have taken in the first instance, but you just kind of needed to air it out with someone and sense check that you're not crazy?
That's well, like I said, I went to my friend after I closed the Shine Box, and she helped me see, you know, she planted the seed for the restory, you know, so things like that. Yeah.
I know it's a very leading question that I ask you. It's just having asked some others on the show. It is, that is kind of the conclusion that they arrive at, is it, they kind of know, whether it's intuitively or, you know, maybe there's a lack of confidence, they're just not quite sure, but speaking it through with somebody just helps. Even if they disagree, even if they've got a different point of view, that's also a good test, because it also shows how, oh no, actually I do think this is the right thing, right?
So I don't know that I have like a specific framework, and having being an ex-consultant, I know that every not all frameworks work perfectly in all situations, so it does help you kind of look, like, think through things. But I think for me it was, you know, just, you know, you start talking to people who are smarter than you or have or tend to kind of view things from a certain angle, and I know enough that even if it's uncomfortable, it's going to be valuable. And and somebody told me, kind of, I wish, like, too late in life, I wish that somebody told me this when I was young, like, everyone's just faking it. So just ask. Like, I was explaining even to my 13-year-old son the other day, he was complaining about one of his teachers, and I was like, you know what's going on in her head? Because I see her. She's like 28-year-old woman. I'm like, she's standing up in front of a room full of 14-year-old boys. I'm like, here's what's going on in her head. You know, and she's tough because she kind of feels like she needs to be, and she needs to put on this persona. So, like, we're all faking it. So I learned a long time, not too long, longer ago than I wish I had known it younger, but I knew it long enough ago that, you know, just ask, don't be shy, be vulnerable.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not really
And something I'd like to add to that is, I do think most people like to be asked. I think that's something that's a really important message, right?
Because, and it's helpful to them too. And whenever anybody would call me and ask me anything, like,
you're so grateful to be thought of.
Well, it's flattering to be asked,
right?
But it's also like thinking through somebody else's problems, like,
is much easier.
It helps you think through your own,
right?
Because when you're to think through someone else's problems, it's you know, you can see it better than they can, obviously, but it also helps you. You go back and it helps you think through your own issues,
yeah.
Like, what, you know, and then you can go, I don't know, you can do things like, what would I tell myself to do if it were, you know, things like that.
Yeah, amazing, great advice. So the time has absolutely flown. I don't know how this has happened, because I feel like we're kind of warming up, but I'm really grateful for you sharing your story and what you've been through. You know, lots of lessons learned that, you know,
I have
founders.
A lot to share.
Yeah, no,
I've
absolutely.
Got a lot of lessons at this stage.
Not everyone has set up their own business, let alone a number of businesses, and then let alone, you know, that number's even smaller of founders who have exited, and then that number goes even smaller when that exit doesn't quite go to plan either. So you're definitely in a very tiny minority, which is important, you know, to have you here and share your story. The final question, which is the tradition on the show, Strategy and Tragedy, is often the biggest, the best lessons come from the biggest mistakes or tragedies. Obviously, you've had your fair share of tragedies with your business story. What's one that's really stuck with you, that's taught you an unforgettable lesson?
The relationships, and to not get caught in the trap of being wholly reliant on external funding.
That's a really important message, especially now where people are so desperate for funding.
Yeah, I mean, if you're getting funding to fund because you're trying to create an opportunity landscape, because you're trying to change one, you're trying to take advantage of something, you're trying to scale, like, great, you can operate in the red. But if the unit economics won't hold under stress, you're just
making things worse.
And
for
it's
yourself.
Very hard to scale and get to anything that looks like profitability.
Yeah, absolutely. Wise words from Vanessa Jacobs. Thank you so much again for joining, for sharing some of your story. Really genuinely excited to see, you know, what you do next. You've got, you know, a lot of things that are on your side that are going in your, the headwinds are in your direction.
We're wiser and we're a little bit meaner.
Wiser and a little bit meaner. I love it. Well, watch this space. Do check out Circulo. Thank you so much for listening as well. I really hope you've enjoyed this episode. Do subscribe if you haven't already and stay tuned for our next episode. We do them weekly, so the next one will be out next week. Thank you so much and see you soon.